This is an ABC podcast.
Dr. Nikki Stamp is a heart and lung surgeon based at Fiona Stanley Hospital in Perth. This means Nikki knows what it's like to open a patient's chest and see a still beating heart and then try to repair it or replace it with another one. The heart is something that's always been spoken of as the seat of our emotions. Now, we know, of course, that's not true. But the heart can certainly be swayed by emotions and hurt by them. And this is why Nikki Stamp has called her book, Can You Die of a Broken Heart? A Heart Surgeon's Insight into What Makes Us Tick. Hello, Nikki.
Hi, Richard.
I'm going to get straight into the patient, if that's all right.
Go for it.
Years ago, you write that you met a patient called Michael. Tell me how he looked when he came into hospital.
So doctors and nurses talk about people who just look sick. There's nothing objective about it. They just look unwell. And he was one of those people where if you stood at the end of the bed, he was not right.
What was his colour like?
He was this awful grey, clammy, just not the right colour for a normal, healthy human. And he had just returned from travelling. He was a young man, so he'd done the things that young men did, run away, Southeast Asia, enjoying life between his study breaks. And he returned just not feeling well. He thought he had the flu. He thought he'd picked up something on his travels. But eventually he went from feeling not well to feeling like he couldn't even get out of bed, and he came to hospital and he was sick. His life was at risk.
Was there swelling? Was he swollen?
Yeah.
Up?
So he had, his legs were bigger than they used to be. And he told us that his tummy was bigger than it used to be. And that was another thing that worried him, that maybe thought that actually it wasn't the flu. And that was one of the many reasons why he eventually came to hospital. And we got involved when the reason that he was sick was shown to be his heart.
And what was wrong with his heart?
So it's a little hard to pinpoint whether or not he had picked up an infection or it was just bad timing, but his heart had become incredibly weak and developed a disease called cardiomyopathy, which is just a fancy doctor way of saying heart muscle disease. As you know, we like to complicate things a little bit from time to time. But he had developed this illness, which had resulted in heart failure.
Heart failure.
Heart failure. Okay. So when you get heart failure, what happens is that the heart is unable to pump enough blood around the body to meet the needs of all of your tissues and organs, from your muscles to your liver to your stomach to your brain and kidneys.
So there wasn't enough oxygen getting onto the vital organs,
right,
from
yeah,
the heart.
Exactly.
Does it make any sense to say the heart is dying under those circumstances, or is it failing, or is it, I suppose the question I'm asking is, was it on some kind of a track to becoming completely broken down?
Pretty much. Heart failure eventually does, that's what it does. It completely breaks down. On the way to that point, though, our hearts are really smart. And even when they get sick, even when you're sick, somewhere else, for example, that they can compensate to a point. But then you're living on a knife's edge and you get to this point, like this critical point where it can no longer keep up, it can no longer compensate, and it kind of gives up the ghost a bit.
So was his heart repairable, or did it need to be replaced?
Unfortunately not. And that is one of the problems when you have a disease that affects the heart muscle, particularly when it affects the whole heart muscle, as opposed to one smaller part of the heart, that it isn't something that you can, not at the moment anyway, take out that small part and fix it. So when the whole heart fails, the options are limited.
Yeah, well, what were his options then?
So when people present with heart failure, they get medicines, and that's what he was getting, really strong medicines to improve his blood pressure, to help his heart pump a little bit better, to reduce some of this fluid that was causing all this swelling. So those are the sort of things that you start off with.
But that's just propping him up, is it?
It is a little bit. It's there to sort of make him feel a little bit better, but also try and, I guess, prevent some of these other organs from becoming casualties. And once you go, once you sort of maximize the amount of those medicines that you're on, what you then look for are things to support the pumping. So this patient had a little pump inserted through the groin called a balloon pump, because it looks like a balloon and it blows up with the heartbeat. And what that does is that improves the blood flow to the body.
Well, hang on. You're saying I'm not really up to date with any of this stuff, Nikki. Are you saying you put a pump into his system through his groin?
Correct.
And it just went zip and landed in the heart in the right place you needed it to be at?
Yeah, so it, well, we check. We watch where it goes.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. But nonetheless, can you be pretty confident once you put it in the bloodstream from down there, it's going to find its way to where it needs to be?
Absolutely, yeah. So it's actually not in the heart. It's just beyond the heart. Aorta, the main blood vessel out of the heart. And it's a very old-fashioned in some ways, but still a very effective way. But it's a temporizing measure.
Right. So it just opened up things a bit, did it?
Correct. It just helps the heart pump a little bit easier.
So long-term, did he require a transplant then?
Yeah. So this poor man came to us. Like I said, he'd shown to have heart failure. And the only really option for him was over the long term was transplant.
So was there a donor heart available there and then?
No. And this is the problem when you have a sick heart, that it's at this stage, like I said, I'm feeling very hopeful that maybe one day there will be a shelf of hearts that we could go to.
Right.
But not at the moment. Not at the moment. So we have the next best thing, which are mechanical hearts, which we call ventricular assist devices, or VADs for short. And that's what he got. So he was wheeled into the operating theatre. And there's no better way of making someone look sicker than they actually are by attaching them to dozens of machines and medicine drips and things like that. And he came into the operating theatre and he had a VAD inserted.
So that was just to sustain him until he could get a donor heart?
Right. So we use VADs nowadays to sustain people. It helps them to rehabilitate, to get stronger in their muscles. It helps them to live a life as well, so that you're not tethered to medicines and hospitals.
So is he able to leave hospital for a bit then after
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Okay. So
yeah.
But he's still on the, he's still waiting for a phone call.
Correct. So they go home, they do as much normal life as they can. They go to the gym, they work out, they have to be strong to come for the transplant in as best possible physical condition as they can. And then they wait.
And then one day the phone rings.
One day the phone rings.
And how does that phone call go?
So what normally happens is one of the transplant coordinators, who are very specialized nurses, will call that patient and say something along the lines of, a donor organ has become available. Make your way into the hospital. Don't eat anything more.
Right, there and then. That's it.
That's it.
Typically, where has that donor heart come from?
So it comes from a patient who is brain dead. So that is, by international law and Australian law, someone who has irreversible cessation of brain function.
They've had some kind of massive head injury from a car accident or something
like that. Or a bleed into the brain.
Right.
They are deceased, and their family have made the incredible selfless decision to donate that person's organs.
They're deceased, but the heart's still beating.
Is that what you're saying? It's a very hard concept to kind of wrap your head around, isn't it?
Okay, so then you have this incredibly amazing family who have agreed to surrender the heart of this person.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens with the heart then? Is it does it's extracted and then has it stopped beating when it's been extracted?
Yeah, so we go out, a surgical team will go out to wherever this person is, and we perform an operation to retrieve that person's organs. And typically people donate more than one thing. So it might be heart and lungs and liver and kidneys, and of course tissues like bone and cornea. But we go out to that hospital and we perform the surgical procedure to take the patient's heart out of their chest. And what happens is we give the heart a really special solution, a kind of medicine that preserves the heart. It stops the heart and it preserves the heart.
What do you mean you give it? Do you mean you immerse it or you inject it?
We inject it directly into the aorta.
Okay. And that stops the heart.
It stops the heart, but it also preserves it. So there's medicines in there that keep the heart safe for the period of transport. And after that, it gets very cold.
and it goes into an esky. It does go into an esky.
Yeah, traditionally, that's changing at the moment. There is new technology that actually allows us to put a heart onto a special rig where we give it the blood of that donor and the heart beats in a box.
Now, you work in Perth. Mm-hmm. Perth, as far as I know, the most remote big city in the world. So yes. Your source of donor organs, how far afield can they come from? Can they come from Cairns or Adelaide, or is there a kind of a limit there? Or?
There is a limit, and you're absolutely right. In Perth, for example, we are kind of limited in that regard because we can't go as far afield as we would like to, because if you put a heart in an esky, you have about 4 hours to transplant that organ.
That's it?
Yeah, it's
4 hours.
It's really short.
Right, yeah. And then necrosis kicks in on the heart, does it?
Exactly, it won't work.
It won't. Oh, right. So you've got to get it there really quick. So
right.
Does that mean? Oh, so that must mean then the patient, the recipient, while it's being taken out, wherever it is being taken out from, mm-hmm. they're getting ready for surgery then at
correct.
The same time.
Correct. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So there's a mad scramble, in other words.
Not a mad scramble. It's a well orchestrated scramble.
Right, okay. Fair enough. I believe you. I'm sure you can't just go open it up.
There's a lot of planning that goes into it, and a lot of negotiating and working things out.
So you're pressing a button, in other words, and saying, all the preparations are in place.
The preparations are always in place.
Okay. So while the organ is being, while the heart's being transported, mm-hmm. The patient is being prepared and undergoing anaesthetic even at that point?
Absolutely. Right. Sometimes, depending on how far away you are and the difficulty of that recipient, that patient who's going to get that new heart, the difficulty of their operation, you may even start it while the heart is on its way.
So then you have to go into the patient, go mm-hmm. into the recipient. The first thing is, stop me if I'm wrong here, you need a scalpel to cut into the chest.
Right.
Then you have to open the ribs. Do you need a bone saw for that? Or,
yes.
Or how do you get in through the ribs?
We do. We go straight through the sternum, which is the ribs connect in the middle of our chest to the breastbone, which we call the sternum, and we use a bone saw. It's very, very sort of DIY.
And does that take a huge amount of physical force to cut through?
No, it doesn't actually. We're blessed with these amazing instruments. We're very lucky, and it just saws the breastbone open and reveals the heart underneath.
And that doesn't sound too ghoulish, but I'm kind of fascinated by this. What you're seeing in this is really what would seem to, I think, people like me to be a fascinating and weird process. Do the ribs open up like the doors of a cage or something, or do they open up like flaps? Or
well, once the breastbone is divided, we put a retractor in, and that sort of slowly cranks open the sternum, the breastbone. And our bodies are all connected, so it doesn't kind of open like a book. It opens all the way around the chest. It all scrunches up and around, and it reveals underneath you've got the heart sitting there. In the cases of patients who have a VAD, a ventricular assist device, that you will see some of that hardware as well. And you can see the lungs on either side.
Now, the human body, of course, you're doing something incredibly invasive to save a life here, but there must be a million things going on in the human body going, this is an outrage, this should not be happening, and this needs to stop. It must go into shock and all sorts of things like that. Does the anaesthetic take care of all that?
Yeah, it's insulting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, get out of my chest.
Yeah, like, things are bad enough.
That's right.
And now you're cutting me open.
Stop
man.
Poking me.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, anaesthesia is amazing. Anaesthesia and anaesthetists do an amazing job at controlling some of that, the body's natural response. And part of anaesthesia is to keep the patient asleep and dull the pain, not that they feel consciously alone, but also the pain that they perceive, so that they don't react. But it's still a stress. It's still a stress on the body, for sure.
So once you've got the ribs pulled apart,
mm-hmm.
then is it the lungs in the way after that? Is that
no,
in the way?
No,
no, no, it's
so,
not.
So the lungs kind of cuddle the heart. So they sit either side. The left lung slightly sneaks over the top of the heart, but the heart is...
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Right. See, I thought it was on top. I'm imagining a human as a layer cake or something like that, I think. but so it's cuddling. I like that. It's nice.
Yeah,
it's
nice. Giving me a little hug.
Right. And then you separate them, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. So the lungs sit in their own sort of sacs in each chest, each left and right chest. And then in the middle, the heart sits in its own sac called pericardium. So someone once upon a time loved Latin terms for all of the anatomy of the body. But the pericardium is a fibrous sac that the heart sits in.
What a bag of a kind, that a fleshy bag.
Very fancy bag, I
fancy
think.
Fancy bag, right. And why does it need to be in that? It needs to be plugged into the lungs, doesn't it? So
yeah.
So why is it in I wonder, is there a reason for that fleshy sac?
Yeah, so we think that it sits in a sac because it's protective. It allows the heart to move without being impeded by something else. So in normal people, within that sac, there's a few mils of this fluid. It's like a lubricant,
I see.
In your car, so that it moves gently and freely.
Once you've opened that, then you're there at the heart. Is that incredibly weird when you see a beating heart in an open chest for the first time in your life?
Do you know, it isn't to me anymore. I think it's, you know, it's become every day, obviously. But I can't quite pinpoint the first time I saw a heart, but I can remember that vague period of time when I did think that, oh, wow, this is special, very special.
And then what do? You're looking at the beating heart, the bad beating heart. Yeah. What do you do?
Usually we say, oh, gosh, this looks really bad. Yeah. Always good to confirm that. So we connect the patient to the heart-lung machine, which is an amazing piece of technology. It's only been around for only about 50-odd years. And it's actually allowed us to do these operations. So we put pipes into the patient's heart, into the blood vessels around their heart, and we connect them and the blood rushes out of their heart, and this machine takes over the work of their heart, the heart and lungs.
And so in that process, then you're ready, the heart is then cut off from all of its arteries and it can be then removed?
The process of being cut off. So we then have to physically cut it off. We clamp the outflow, we clamp the aorta so that no blood is going to get to that heart. And as the machine's doing the work, like I say, of the heart and lungs, then yeah, that sick heart is cut out, which isn't always straightforward, particularly if someone's had surgery before. If you cut your skin, you get a scar. If you had been in the chest before, you get scar all around the heart. And explanting or taking out a VAD, a mechanical heart, at the same time is hard work.
And I have to ask, what happens to the old bad heart? I mean, no one's got any use for it. So is it, what do you do with it? Do you throw it out? Do you burn it? Where would you put such a thing?
Like a ritualized burning, maybe?
I don't know. Or do you just throw it in the bin? What happens to the bad heart?
It actually goes off to the lab. It goes to the pathology lab and they look at it and they say, yes, this was whatever.
Bad heart.
That's right. That's right. They tell us what they see. Occasionally some people give their hearts and to research. It gets looked at. It doesn't quite go in the bin.
So then you've got to put the new heart in.
Mm-hmm.
And you connect it up to all, you do a lot of sewing at this point, I'm guessing.
Right.
You sew it to connect to the aorta and the various valves and pumps and bells and whistles that are there around the body, put it that way. And is that must be a really long, laborious process.
Do you know, the sewing in is the shortest part of the
really?
Whole operation.
Right.
Yeah, because it's plumbing. It's fancy plumbing. I had a boss once who used to call himself a fancy plumber.
Right.
And that's kind of what it feels like. You're joining up tubes.
Plumber is one thing, but seamstress is another too, isn't it? Surgeons have to be that. Aren't they really fine little sutures you have to do?
Absolutely. I mean, so some of the finer sutures I use for, say, sewing a coronary artery, which are the arteries that supply blood to the heart, they're, a millimetre or two wide. I would use a suture, a stitch that is about the size of a human hair.
So once you're into that finish, once you've completed that process, you've got it all tubed up, and then what's it like then to see blood rushing into the new heart and seeing it and pumping again?
There is a moment where you take the clamp off and the blood does rush back into the heart, and there's this kind of moment where you're looking at it going, please work.
Yeah.
And when it does, when it starts beating by itself, I don't think that stops being amazing.
And what starts it beating? Do you need to give it an electrical shock or something? Or
no,
what?
It's blood. So that's the amazing thing about the heart. This is my favorite fact about the heart, is that if you give heart muscle cells, either as cells or as a whole heart, if you give it blood, if you give it oxygen, nutrient-rich blood, those muscle cells start beating.
They just know what to do.
They know exactly what to do.
How long have you been in surgery at this point by the time you've got the new heart beating?
On a quick transplant, so that's if perhaps someone hasn't had heart surgery before, so it's the first time and there's no scar tissue. 3 or 4 hours?
Right. You're probably getting a little bit shagged at this point. So does someone then take over to do the patching up?
No. We're full of stamina.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So then you begin the repair work then of putting it back in, nestled back into the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
Repairing the
We take it off the heart lung machine first. So that new heart has to be it's slowly introduced to doing its work.
And then you repair the broken rib,
right,
sternum,
yeah.
and then you stitch the chest back up.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds easy.
It
does sound easy. Yes, piece of cake. Yes, and I've been paying a lot of attention. I think I'm ready to do it myself, Nikki.
I'll call you.
I mean, clearly afterwards, in the aftermath, the body's gone through a major trauma, having been through all this. But and then, how long is it before the patient starts to feel well and like really well after that?
Interesting question, because some people wake up after a transplant or after any kind of heart surgery and they feel a difference straight away. And that's incredible to see. For the first little while, though, they're kind of upset with you for cutting open their chest. And they're a bit sore and a little bit groggy because we keep them asleep for a little while after the surgery in the intensive care unit. And we monitor everything. We monitor their heart, their lungs, their kidneys, their brain. We monitor everything. Anything you can think of, we're looking at it. And then when they wake up, there is that moment where I think there's a lot of gratitude, obviously for the process, for the donor, but also a lot of people are just so happy to be here. They're just so relieved that they've woken up and things are fine.
And once they're well into recovery, though, and I know this from just not from my own experience because I've never had this happen to me, but stories like this, is it typical that then you will have a patient then with a proper functioning heart that feels better than they have in years afterwards?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And lungs are amazing. Lungs, I mean, I don't want to play favourites here. It's like having a favourite child. I do love hearts, but I also, have a lot to do with the lungs. And the lung transplant patients, they're amazing. And that was one of the first things for me that really cemented this is what I wanted to do, when a lung transplant patient said to me, "You have no idea how good it feels to be able to breathe."
Was this from an emphysema patient or someone like that?
Yes, it was actually. Yeah. And
because emphysema feels like you're slowly drowning, doesn't it?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, if you can imagine not being able to go to the toilet without feeling short of breath, and then to wake up and feel that difference, it's indescribable for us to hear that. And so I can't even imagine what that patient feels like.
Do heart transplant patients undergo a full recovery? Are they is the heart beating the same way as their native one does, for example?
Not quite. So there's a few subtle differences. So the heart has nerves, just like we have to our muscles, whatever, skin, that give messages and take messages away. Those are cut during the transplant, which means that you don't have that nervous system, that brain or spinal cord control over the heart. But this is where the heart's super clever. So it knows, it just knows by the amount of blood it gets back. It knows by how full it is or how empty it is, how fast it needs to beat, how hard it needs to beat. And that's a way that it overcomes not having that nervous system signal anymore.
Have you held a heart in your hands?
Yes, multiple times.
Are they? I'm told that they're like rock hard bits of muscle. Is that right? Are they heavy or what are they? Woody or what are they
no,
like?
No, they are. That is a really good question that no one has actually ever asked me before. They feel like they feel different if they're sick, and they feel different if they're healthy.
How?
Like a really heavy, stiff heart would be a sick heart. A really baggy, soft heart would also be a sick heart.
Yeah, it sounds like checking out an avocado in the supermarket.
It is a little bit, yeah, right. But we try not to squeeze a heart too hard.
Right.
It's frowned upon.
and so you can tell by the squishiness, I suppose, is it? Or the shape or the
all of the above.
Right.
All of the above, yeah.
Is this particularly satisfying work when it all comes off?
Yeah, for sure. It has to be. It has to be. You have to love it. You have to be satisfied by it. You have to enjoy it and be you know, still in awe of it every day because it's such a privilege, but there is also, I suppose, a burden to bear. There's a huge amount of responsibility. You are literally responsible for people's lives. It's very stressful. So if you don't love it, if you don't see the positive in it, then you won't do it. So it's very satisfying.
Do people feel weirded out by having a different person's heart in their chest?
Some people do. Some people are just so, so grateful. But yeah, there is that moment where you realise that it's mine now, but it hasn't always been. They're so grateful. The transplant patients are always just so, so grateful because, as we all know, that is an incredibly difficult decision for that family to make.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
When did you decide you were going to be a surgeon, Nikki?
I had a slightly convoluted route to becoming a surgeon, to be honest. When I was 8, though, I was a precocious child. Mm. I had written in my, you know, journal, my school journal, when I grew up, I want to be a heart surgeon and finish the work of Victor Chang, which is very normal for an 8-year-old.
Yeah, how did you even know about what Victor Chang? That's amazing for an 8-year-old to be aware of that.
I think I used to see him on TV, and I do remember seeing him, you know, on the news talking about how he was working on a new mechanical heart and how that would solve all the problems that come with heart transplants, such as waiting for a heart. And I was just amazed by it. I loved the human body, even as a kid. I used to read cover to cover books about the body. I read the St. John's first aid manual from cover to cover as a kid. I was ready to go. If someone was choking, I was there. I just loved it. And that's what I wanted to do with my life. But on the way, I got a little bit sidetracked. I sort of went through the standard, I guess, teenage process of wanting to do about a dozen other things. And what I actually wanted to do when I was finishing school was I was going to go and study musical theatre. And my dad, in his wisdom, told me I had to get a real degree first. And I was going to be an accountant. I was enrolled in accounting.
Whoa, hang on. That's a whole other world. You know, yeah, like from heart surgery to musical theatre to accounting. Wow.
That's, I told you I changed my mind a bit. Right. But, you know, at the last minute, I was like, this is not right. This is not for me. It's not what I want to do. And my dad took away all the brochures. You know, you get all those brochures from all the different universities. And he said, if you could do anything in the world, what would you want to be? And I said, I'd be a doctor. And so I set about getting into medicine, and I studied science for a year, and then I got into medicine, and from the get-go, I was always going to be a surgeon. It was not negotiable, and my family, I thought this was weird, my family, like, no, this is what you were always going to do. And then it started to sort of come flooding back. I was like, oh, yeah, Victor Chang.
Right. It wasn't like, you go back to a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet, young lady. No.
No, it was definitely not. Right. No, definitely not.
Was there any heart disease in the family?
Oh, well, sort of. So my grandfather had 2 heart attacks when he was quite a young man. So I think he was in his 40s, perhaps. And that happened at a time when we had no good treatment for heart disease. So that was a time when they would sort of let you sit in hospital, lay in a bed, don't move, you're sick, get better, which is completely, completely opposite to what we do now. So he was always quite sick from his heart. This is how my dad tells it. And then around the time when I was obsessed, I suppose, with Victor Chang, my grandfather had a kind of lung cancer called mesothelioma, which we associate with
asbestos.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think I was always, I suppose, you know, obviously sad and worried and, you know, normal family member with that illness, but I was intrigued by it as well.
I think most people's understanding of what happens in a heart attack is when, like, Homer Simpson eats 18 donuts and a whole stick of butter and then goes, dah, like that. What's wrong with that picture? What normally happens when someone has a heart attack?
Well, First of all, I'm not sure anyone can eat 18 donuts.
I'm pretty sure they can. I don't think you're trying hard enough there. If you were committing to donut eating rather than heart and lung surgery, you would have achieved that. You're a committed person.
Yeah, that's right. Say. Yeah, yeah. I put my talents in the wrong place. Yeah,
in the wrong place. That's right. Yes.
So, look, a heart attack is generally the sort of standard type develops over many years. So, it's a combination of our genetics, what we're born with, and what we do to ourselves. Do we smoke? Do we exercise? What do we eat? You know, a whole host of other things that causes a buildup of plaque inside the walls of our arteries. And in a heart attack, that happens in the coronary arteries.
I have to ask. Plaque. You mean like tooth plaque or what is it?
So it's closer to gunky fat than tooth plaque.
Right.
So it forms within the walls of the arteries and it's made up of cholesterol. It's made up of immune cells called macrophages. They're the ones that go and eat anything that bothers it. And it's made of smooth muscle cells. It's a complex.
Oh, it's a rubbish dump then, is it? It sounds like a real rubbish dump of a whole lot of things.
It's an aggressive rubbish dump. So all these cells, all these molecules, they've all been aggravated and activated and they nestle into the wall and they grow bigger and bigger and bigger and then eventually they rupture usually and that causes blood to clot on top of it and that combination of that plaque with that blood clot blocks off the coronary artery and the muscle beyond it gets no blood supply. It dies.
And then what do you feel at that point? Do you feel pain or pressure or what?
Yeah. So most people who get that chest pain have described it to me as like something sitting on their chest, whether it be a bus or an elephant or someone else.
Why would it feel like that? I wonder if it's a blockage rather than a pressure, an external
force.
Yeah,
interesting because the heart has nerve endings that tell us that it's sore, it's in pain, but they're not specific. So, you know, if you have a broken finger, you can close your eyes and you know exactly where that pain is coming from. Your heart has not that level of sensitivity or specificity. It knows that it's sore. It's not 100% sure where it is. So you feel it as this interesting dull pain, this pressure.
Right. Sometimes, is that all it can be? Just to sort of, it's not necessarily a,
It's not necessarily. So some people don't feel pain, even though they're having a heart attack. And that typically happens in diabetic patients who have damage to their nerve endings. So they may feel something odd. So they might feel shortness of breath. They might feel nauseous. They might feel discomfort somewhere else. So it's very common to have that pain come up elsewhere, like in the neck, in the jaw, in your arm, in your back, sometimes in your tummy even.
So the problem is all this plaque, you're saying.
Right.
How do you get it out?
Well, you can't. It lives there. It's stuck there.
Forever?
Forever.
Unless you have open heart surgery and get it out.
Even open heart surgery can't get it out. Trust me, if I could work out a way to get rid of it, I'd be very rich.
Really? So it's is it like welded to the artery wall?
Well,
or something,
it's
is
inside
it, or
the artery wall. So it's within the layers of the artery wall. So you can't get rid of it. Once it's there, it's there.
I'm going to reach for another fast food analogy. It's like cheese inside a pizza.
In the crust.
In the crust.
Yes, in the crust.
So that's what it's like, is it? So you can't get it out with destroying the pizza. Yes, and just as gross too. And it just shouldn't be there at all at any stage. So then what do you do? Do you just widen it? Do you, but with a stent or something like that?
You can do. That's one of the ways of treating it. So that would be done by a cardiologist. That's a doctor who specializes in the medical treatment of heart disease. Whereas for us, we bypass it. So going back to being a fancy plumber, it is like building a road around a blockage. We're plumbing around that blockage.
How are heart attacks different for women?
Yeah, this is a major problem because women are much less likely than men to feel chest pain. So it's very hard to pinpoint what exactly is wrong. They often turn up with much less specific symptoms like tiredness, like shortness of breath. And I remember being at a function for women in heart disease. And I said, you know, a lot of women feel tired and you could see the whole room roll their eyes at me going, I'm always tired.
If that's how it presents itself very often in women, mm-hmm. what do you do about that? How do you tell women you can't send a woman to the doctor every time she feels tired.
No, because that would be every day.
Every day all the time.
Running around after everyone, you know, mm-hmm. you're always tired. I'm always tired. It doesn't mean I'm having a heart attack. These other symptoms tend to occur as well. So shortness of breath is quite a common one, or suddenly not being able to exercise or exert themselves like they used to. So even like things around the house, if you have a staircase and you can't walk up it, that's something to be concerned about. It's about knowing your body. It's always also about knowing your risk. So if you know that you are unfortunate enough to have the genetics for it, if you're unfortunate enough to have high blood pressure, diabetes, if you've smoked, all these kind of precursor conditions, then you should be a little bit more aware and a little bit more vigilant and perhaps a little bit more willing to get yourself checked out. Easier said than done, of course.
Does that mean, though, because when a heart attack presents in a woman with more vague symptoms, mm-hmm. perhaps, than a man, mm-hmm. that when things finally do go wrong, it's catastrophic and often results in death?
It can be, yeah. So women have less numbers of heart attacks than men.
Yeah, so you're not as likely to suspect heart attack again because
women
get fewer heart attacks.
Yeah, well, yes, but it's a little bit of a mix of things. So it is that we don't think that it's a woman's disease, rather, that the woman doesn't think that. She'll say, oh, I'm tired because I'm tired. or also I've got a billion things to do.
I just need a good night's sleep.
I just need a holiday. I just need something else. I'm unfit.
I just need your kids to stop aggravating me.
Right. It's always the kids, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not the husband ever, which is great. Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's right. So it is that very easy to dismiss as a woman. And I think healthcare workers are still just learning now that heart attacks present differently in women and that we need to be suspect of them. But women don't do as well. They tend not to get treatment in a timely fashion. Again, this is a cultural thing. We are more likely to attribute a woman's symptoms to anxiety, which is terrible. I mean, it's really, really terrible that we're healthcare workers, the community, we say, oh, she's just being a bit dramatic. And that's killing people. We've got to stop attributing disease to drama.
Anecdotally, is it true or through research that once a patient's had heart surgery for a heart attack as opposed to a heart transplant, they often experience a rather nasty bout of depression afterwards?
Yeah, they can do. And any major illness or chronic illness can cause depression, which is very understandable, right? Mm. It's an incredible stress on themselves, on their family, financially, all these other things.
And you can't do what you feel you ought to be doing.
Right. It's something that I always warn my patients about after surgery. And I see not infrequently where people just feel a bit down. They come for their 6-week follow-up and I've got, Joe Bloggs, who's a big, tough Aussie man, sitting in my office crying.
Right.
And it's awful because they feel so, so terrible and they don't really know why. It is such a stress on the brain.
It brings us to the title of your book, Can You Die of a Broken Heart? I mean, is there such a thing, really? I mean, broken heart. Is there any kind of medical term that aligns itself with this idea?
Yes. So it's a bit of a spectrum, though, because most of us have a broken heart at some time in our life. It's a, unfortunate side effect of the human condition. We're all going to be brokenhearted, but most of us won't die of them, which is great. Really good news. But there are a couple of things that can happen. So first of all, even if you are bereaved or you've split up from someone or some other sort of stressor, there is a lot of hormones and other cell signaling that basically leads to you having an incredible amount of stress on your body and particularly your heart. Can that kill you? Sometimes it can precipitate, say, a heart attack if you were at risk of it. And one of the things I love, really,
someone can get a heart attack after a broken up relationship.
Totally.
or the death of someone they love.
Yeah, absolutely. I read a paper recently about stress and how it affects the heart. And for someone who already has heart disease, if you are watching the World Cup soccer, you are 4 times more likely to have another heart problem. Maybe I wanted to write to that author and say, can you please elaborate? Does this depend on how your team is going?
Otherwise, there's no soccer for you.
That's right. Yes. Sorry, it's only curling from now on.
But is this an actual medically recognized condition, though?
So the most extreme end of all of this is something called Takotsubo. So it's a Japanese name. It's a disease that was first described in the 1990s. And what they found were that there was predominantly postmenopausal women were coming to hospital looking for all the world like they were having a heart attack. They had the blood tests, they had the ECG, the electrical tracing of the heart that proved it, and they had the symptoms. But when they went to the lab to look at the coronary arteries by injecting a special dye into them, their arteries were plumb normal, absolutely normal. But their heart, their left ventricle, which is the main pumping chamber of the heart, was all blown out and not pumping well. And it looked like Japanese Fisher pots, which are called Takotsubo, hence the name Takotsubo. And it is a rare, rare condition. It affects women more than men. And for women, it tends to happen after a major stress like bereavement, for example. For men, it's more likely to happen after a physical stress like being in a fight. And most people recover. Some people don't. Some people have life-threatening complications from it, such as a funny heart rhythm or heart failure. And one in five people have it again who have it if they've had it once.
Does it possibly explain why you have those stories of when a couple have been married for 60 years or something and one dies and the other one follows shortly afterwards?
Possibly, but for those types of cases, for anyone who's bereaved, there is in the first 30 days a higher risk of passing away yourself, especially if you already have illness. So these tend to be older couples and they tend to have other issues, right? And then that stress is enough to sort of tip them over, tip it over the edge, really. But it is possible that that can happen.
Nikki, before you were talking about a kind of an interim measure for patients who are about to undergo transplants, they'd be fitted with a ventricular assist device or a VAD. For a start, wouldn't it be cooler to call them cyborg hearts? You're such nerds, aren't you guys? I mean, give them a cooler name. Just don't say no right away, okay? Just put that in there.
Next time we have a meeting with the manufacturers, we'll put it to them.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you. How are such things powered?
They are powered at the moment from a battery pack that the patient wears in a bag. You know, just they carry it on their shoulder or on their back, and that's driven through a thing called a drive line, which emerges from the patient's abdomen.
Right, they've got a plug on the abdomen, external plug?
Yeah, they've got like a little tube, like a little power cord that runs from the abdomen, which goes through the abdomen into the pump in the heart.
Can a heart be entirely replaced by one of these devices, a machine of some kind?
Yeah, so generally, most of the time we put one in, a left ventricular assist device, an LVAD, so it just helps the left side of the heart, which pumps blood around the body. The right side of the heart pumps blood to the lungs to get oxygen. Some people can get two. They get an RVAD or right ventricular assist device. And then the next step up from that is something called a total artificial heart, where you're left with very small cuffs of your original heart, and that this total artificial heart or a TAH takes up most of that room, but they're incredibly uncommon.
Yeah, and how well do they work at this stage?
Look, the machinery itself is good, but it tends to be not as well, and they don't do as well as patients who just get an LVAD. Now, that's obviously a sweeping generalisation, and there are plenty of people who have LVADs and RVADs or BIVADs, right? We are pretty nerdy, aren't we? It's only when you say it back to someone else and you go, oh, God. Yeah. But yeah, look, they still, you know, they still do well and they still live full lives and yeah, but it's not as good.
It does say something about the evolutionary process, isn't it, though? That, you know, with the kind of the most brilliant people we have working on these devices, you still can't make something as good as that kind of weird little knot of muscle and tissue.
We think we're so smart and we're not.
And you can't make something that works as well as one of those things.
No. And that's true for the whole body. We think we're really smart. We think we've got this sorted. But the original design is excellent.
And once you put one of these devices inside the chest cavity or around the heart, are they able to collect data and then transmit it through that wire?
Right. Yes, they are. So it keeps whole logs of how fast the pump is spinning, how much power it uses, if there were any alarms. So it's set to record events that might represent a problem, for example. So there's a huge amount of data and it gets downloaded periodically.
Heart surgery hasn't been with us for very long, has it?
No, it's quite a new specialty.
Well, when did it start? What, sometime in the 30s, 40s? Or?
We wish. No. So the first heart surgeries were surgeries to repair stabbed hearts. And that was the first successful heart surgery. And not long after that, so I think it was in the 1920s, very early in that century, were a lot of very learned clever men would say, that's it, we're done. It's too dangerous. Any further pursuit to do heart surgery would be foolish and dangerous.
So what was the critical thing? Was it being able to still a beating heart?
Right, yeah. So, that was a huge thing. But diagnosis was inaccurate as well. So the days before the heart-lung machine, heart surgeons would perform heart surgery generally for children who were born with heart defects. And because they couldn't still the heart, because they couldn't make the diagnosis properly, they just used to use a stethoscope. And that can be incredibly inaccurate. So sometimes they would get in there, find this incredibly complex defect that they were not expecting, and they'd have to sew like mad. Quickly under all the blood, quickly sew it up. And it often didn't work. And the next step was something called cross-circulation. Now, this is one of the most incredible parts of medical history, I think, and obviously I'm biased. But when they realized they needed to be able to stop the heart and they didn't have a reliable machine, they would use a parent. So the parent and the child would be plugged into one another and the parent would act as the heart-lung machine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, is that dangerous for both parties to do that?
Yes, but amazingly, there were no deaths. There was one stroke from the parent. There was one man who wasn't related to the child at all and very selflessly donated his body temporarily, I suppose. It's amazing. And there are a few historical photos around of that, and it's so surreal. It's incredible.
So now you have the heart and lung machine to
now
do that.
We have the heart lung machine,
which will oxygenate the blood and pump it back through the, right, through the body again, so the heart doesn't need to do it temporarily.
Right.
If you give someone a new heart, mm-hmm, how long will it last?
So the median survival, so that's how many people are alive. 50% of people are alive at about 12 to 13 years. In Australia, we do a little bit better, but we're starting to see patients go far, far beyond that 12 to 13 years. We're starting to see people out to 30-odd years. And I think Fiona Coote, who is widely known as one of Victor Chang's important patients, I suppose, early patients in Australia, she's out to 32 years, perhaps. So it's pretty amazing that you can survive that long.
Yeah, that's
great,
pretty cool.
Huh?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Do you keep an eye on future research, where research is going?
Yeah, absolutely.
Where's it going? What's the most interesting side for you?
I think the best thing that we can hope for and we should work towards is having a new heart grown for you, or replacement hearts that are grown specifically for you. And that's certainly possible.
So a cloned heart, in other words.
Almost, yeah. Or being able to repair a broken heart, literally. So we're very clever. We evolved to walk on 2 feet and have big brains, but we forgot to evolve the ability to repair our own hearts. But other species like zebrafish have done that, and they can grow a whole new heart, basically. And we would love to be able to tap into that. And there are people working on this. There are people working on cloning hearts. There are people doing amazing things, and they're learning things about the heart, about the body that we don't even know yet. And I love that. I love that it's still mysterious in that way.
It's been so great to speak with you, Nikki. And I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so
Wonderful.
Much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations. From athletes to aviators, scientists to spies, from the deep blue sea to the dark black skies, the Fierce Girls podcast goes where others dare to dream. Join the amazing Pia Miranda, Marley Silva, Yael Stone, Natalie Tran, Gabby Simpson, Claudia Carvin, Turia Pitt, Stephanie Gilmore and more for inspiring tales of some of Australia's most extraordinary women. The Fierce Girls podcast. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app or wherever you do your listening.